I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day
a soldier of peace,
this nation will rise up,
a soldier of peace,
live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream,
though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day every valley, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed in all flesh, shall see it.
Nonviolence Radio, covering the beat of nonviolence worldwide, from the Meta Center for Nonviolence in Petaluma, California.
So when people say that nonviolence is not relevant today, what they are basically saying is that love and respect and understanding and compassion are not relevant today. And if that be true, then we are doomed.
I'm Stephanie Van Hook, your host on Nonviolence Radio, and that was Arun Gandhi, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, talking about the power of nonviolence and what it really is. I had the chance to interview Arun for Nonviolence Radio, and he spoke about especially the power of anger, because he has a new book out on this topic, as well as some of the deeper dynamics of the culture of nonviolence and some of the lessons of his grandfather that he learned while living with him, but also how we could apply them to our modern context. So let's hear more from Arun.
Gandhi's life began in South Africa. The transformation that took place in his life started in South Africa. And so he had several institutions running there in South Africa. And when he decided to go back to India, he wanted somebody to volunteer to stay back and run those institutions and continue with the protests against apartheid. And so my dad volunteered to stay there, and we lived in the Phoenix Ashram, and my dad did all the work, running the institutions as well as fighting apartheid and prejudice. And so I grew up there with my two sisters, and we became victims of apartheid and prejudice, and the minority whites had really perfected the art of divide and rule. And so they had divided the Indians, the African, and the colored people, and kept them fighting among themselves so that the white people could rule, So the result was that it seemed like everybody hated everybody. And since the Africans were in a majority, they vented their anger towards the Indians. And so we became the butts of hatred from the blacks as well as the whites. And so I had this experience growing up, and I was beaten up at the age of 10 by whites and then by blacks, and I was very angry and I wanted revenge, and that's when my parents realized that I needed some help, and the best that they could think of was to take me and leave me with grandfather, who would teach me how to deal with these things. So at the age of 12, we went to India, and it was not especially to leave me there, but it was one of the occasions when the whole family went to India. We used to go every 3 years to India to connect with the family. But this period, we had been away from India for much longer than 3 years because of World War II. So the last time we had been to India was in 1939, and then until the end of World War II in 1945, we couldn't go. And so it was time for the family to go and kind of rejuvenate themselves. And so we went, and I was left with grandfather. And he, you know, had a way of teaching which was very unique. He never sat me down and preached to me or gave me lessons or anything like that. He would use something that happened during the day to convert that into a lesson. And so the first lesson that he taught me was about anger and how to deal with anger. You know, we never talk about anger. We don't teach anybody how to deal with anger. And the result is that we all end up abusing anger. And he said that anger is good. It's not something that we should be ashamed of or deny. It is a good emotion, but what we need to do is to learn it, learn to use it constructively and intelligently. And so that's what he impressed on me, and he taught me how to not react in a moment of madness, but to take time and think about the situation, find out how best you could deal with the issue that caused the anger in a way that would satisfy all the people involved in it. And, you know, then find a way of doing it and do it. So that, I think, was a very powerful lesson, because Harvard University did a study, and they found that more than 80% of the violence that we experience in our lives, either in our personal lives or in our national lives, is generated by anger. We just get angry and we lash out and say things and do things that sometimes changes the course of our lives completely. And yet we don't have to do that if we learn that to use anger intelligently. We have created a culture of violence because of the materialistic lifestyle that we have chosen. To sustain that materialistic lifestyle, we have created a whole culture of violence. And that culture of violence dominates every aspect of our lives. Our speech, our sports, our entertainment, our relationships, even our religion has now become violent. And so it has steeped to all aspects of our lives. And it's that culture of violence that creates conflicts all the time. And, you know, we try to find peaceful ways of resolving those conflicts. But what we end up doing is band-aid therapy. It's only when a conflict emerges, we try to find a peaceful solution to that conflict. But until we, you know, we don't focus on the entire culture of violence and try to transform that whole culture, we are not going to be able to create peace in the world. We have, you know, humankind has been working for peace for generations now, and we are nowhere near achieving peace because we have not, you know, attempted to change that culture of violence to a culture of nonviolence. I would say that the culture of violence brings out all the worst aspects in human beings. Because the culture, materialism, you know, is based on selfishness, self-centeredness, about greed, about wanting more and more of everything, and so it's a very exploitative society. Everybody is exploiting everybody else, and you know, individually and nationally, and that spawns this whole culture of violence. What we need to do is to make transform it into a culture of nonviolence, because nonviolence is based on all the positive aspects in human being. It's about love and respect and understanding and acceptance and all of these positive things. So when people say that nonviolence is not relevant today, what they are basically saying is that love and respect and understanding and compassion are not relevant today. And if that be true, then we are doomed. You know, if we are going to have to live with these negativities and greed and violence and that kind of thing, then you know, then there is no hope for mankind. We have to understand what nonviolence is and try to practice it effectively. Unfortunately, a lot of people just think of nonviolence as the non-use of physical force, that as long as we are not beating up on each other, if we are not at war with each other, we are living in peace. That is not true, because we are committing violence in many different ways, not just the physical violence, but there's a lot of passive violence that we are committing. And that was a lesson that grandfather taught me by transforming a little incident with a pencil into a major lesson. I was coming back from school and I had this little 3-inch butt of a pencil in my hand, and I just, you know, decided that I deserved a better pencil. This was too small for me to use. And so without a second thought, I just threw the pencil away because I was so sure that grandfather would give me a new one when I asked him for it. But that evening when I met grandfather and asked him for a new pencil, instead of giving me one, he subjected me to a lot of questions. He wanted to know how the pencil became small and where did I throw it away and why did I throw it away and on and on. And I couldn't understand why he was making such a fuss over a little pencil until he told me to go out and look for it. And I said, "You must be joking." I said, "You don't expect me to look for a little pencil in the dark?" He said, "Oh yes, I do. Here's a flashlight." And sent me out with a flashlight to look for this pencil. And I think I spent about 2 hours searching for it. And when I finally found it and brought it to him, he said, "Now I want you to sit here and learn two very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources. And that is violence against nature. And the second lesson is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy things very easily, we overconsume the resources of the world. And because we overconsume them, we are depriving people elsewhere of these resources. And they have to live in poverty, and that is violence against humanity. And that was the first time I realized that nonviolence was not just about not fighting. It was about not exploiting and not wasting and not harming people in different ways. Actually, passive violence, non-physical or passive violence, that fuels the fire of physical violence. So logically, if we want to put out that fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And since the fuel supply comes from each one of us, we have to become the change we wish to see in the world. If we don't change our attitudes and our behavior and our relationships with each other, we are never going to be able to create peace in the world.
That was Arun Gandhi, and you're on Nonviolence Radio. My next question for Arun had to do with the nature of anger and whether somebody can be both nonviolent and have anger within them. And in that context that we looked at his grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi, could we consider Gandhi an angry person and yet also nonviolent? Here's his response.
Oh yes, he was an angry person. Anger is good. It's not something we should deny or oppress or suppress. He was angry, but he had learned to use that anger intelligently, and so he was able to channel that anger intelligently and do things and achieve things. I mean, if he wasn't angry, he wouldn't bother to fight for India's independence or for human rights or justice. He would just, be quite content with his own life. It was anger that motivated him to do things. So anger is good for all. I mean, it's good that we have anger. What is bad is the way we abuse it instead of using it intelligently.
My next question for Arun Gandhi had to do with the political situation in the United States. How can we understand the anger that's being generated toward politicians and toward the political system? What's taking place? This is what he had to say.
I think what we need to do, and what I'm sure my grandfather would have done, was not to look at this in isolation. We tend to look at incidents in isolation only when they become a crisis and we can't ignore them anymore. That we, like terrorism, for instance, we ignored the incidents that led up to terrorism all these years, and even now we still ignore it. And now we are faced with terrorism and we want to put an end to it. And what do? We just send in the Marines and bomb them out. Now, we can't bomb people who are unhappy and for some reason are showing their unhappiness through violence. We have to sit down and find out where did we go wrong and where did we as a society, what do we need to do to change these things. Now, Trump came into power because of the situation in the country, because of the way the politicians have been exploiting everybody for all these years, and they've just gone wild, berserk with this whole democratic setup, with the cost of elections going up so much, and then we elect the politicians so that they would do something for the common people. But once they are elected and they go into Washington, D.C., they are working for the lobbyists and for the big money bags, and so they ignore the poor people. And what happened was all these poor people who have been ignored by society, by politicians all these years, when factories closed down and people were laid off, and because of technology, things had changed and people couldn't follow, were not able to accept those changes because of their ignorance. We didn't do anything to help them, to re-educate them, to help them economically. We just left them to find their own ways, and in many cases, they just suffered. I mean, when you go to all these Appalachia and all these inner city areas in big cities where people are living in misery and poverty and destitution, and you see that in the midst of all the affluence that we have in this country, it's natural that the poor people are going to get angry. And when somebody like Trump comes in and starts stoking the embers and saying that I am going to do something for you and I'm going to clean up Washington, D.C., they fall for it and they elected him. So the blame for that lies with all the politicians, and for all of us, in fact, because we have all ignored the whole situation. And I'm convinced that, things like poverty and all the things that affect people at the human level is not something that can't be tackled by the government alone. the government is not capable of working out of compassion. They can do things bureaucratically, but they can't do anything with compassion. And that is where people need to come into the picture. NGOs and others who come in and try to help the poor people and bring about a change and bring about better understanding and so on. And that is not being done. We just all, you know, are content to do our own thing, and we say, well, eradicating poverty is the government's job, and bringing about better relations between Muslims and others is also the government's job. The government won't do anything. We all have to get together and do the thing. So what I'm saying to people today is, just protesting against Trump and wanting to throw him out is not going to really help our society. What we need to do is to get down to finding out, why did these people vote for Trump, and what were their problems, and what is their situation, and how can we as people get together and help them.
That was Arun Gandhi, and you're on Nonviolence Radio. So my last question for Arun in this interview had to do with the charka, or the spinning wheel, within the Indian freedom struggle, and the way that it guaranteed employment to every single person. It was really the central focus of the constructive energies of the Indian campaign. And the $10 million question of the Mehta Center and here on Nonviolence Radio is, what is the charka, what is the spinning wheel of our movements today? So I thought I would pose this question to Arun. Here's what he had to say.
I think the charka of today is trying to find ways of eradicating poverty and ignorance among people. And there are various different ways there. Charka at that time was relevant because India was in tremendous poverty, and basically because Britain was taking away Indian cotton to produce cloth in England and sell it back to their colonies. The reason why Britain became such an industrialized power so quickly, from agricultural economy to industrial economy, because they had their whole colonies to exploit. So they would take the raw material from the colonies and process it in England and bring it back to the colonies and sell them at higher prices. So when our cotton was taken away, we destroyed our own textile industry, which was going on for centuries because it was a small, cottage industry kind of thing. People in communities were producing their own cloth and spinning and all that. And all that was destroyed by Britain taking away the cotton. And grandfather realized that political independence for India is going to be meaningless as long as economic independence is not achieved. And that's why he evolved the spinning wheel, so that even little children in the villages could spin and produce their own cloth and revitalize the cottage industry that was thriving at one time when they were making handloom clothes and providing for the villagers there. And so that was very relevant at that time, but that's not relevant today because, things have changed today So we have to find different ways. Now, one of the things that I do now, where I've been doing it for the last 18 years, is taking a group of people on a Gandhi legacy tour. And we go to India every year. And I have identified 10 amazing programs where individuals have started the program and transformed the lives of millions of people just, you know, by their dedicated service. Now, there are different kinds of programs. There's Seva. I don't know whether you've ever heard of an organization called Seva in Ahmedabad. Seva was started by one lady, Ila Bhatt, many years ago, and she was giving her own money to very poor women to start their own little business and try to earn something to supplement the family income. And that grew, and more women came to her. And then she started organizing things in a better way, and she got more funding. And now, in about less than 40 years or 50 years since she started this microloan thing, she is now covering about 10 million women in India. And now they have expanded to Afghanistan and other countries too. So, you know, she has really transformed their lives. They now have their own cooperative bank, and they don't have to depend on the commercial banks. And the lives of 10 million women has been transformed. So these are the kinds of things, these are the charkhas of today that we need to discover and work for, so that we can bring about a change in humanity. Nonviolence empowers us to do things. We don't have to be helpless, and we don't have to say, well, what can I do? You know, these are the problems of other people, and they have to resolve it. It's not my business. That selfishness is from the culture of violence. But when we adopt the culture of nonviolence, then we become more giving and more compassionate, and we look at all the problems within our society as our own problems, and how we try to find resolutions of those problems.
There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. It transcends the senses. While everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates.
When peace breaks out, nothing but silence. From the mainstream media show, we want to know about nonviolence. Where do we go? Nonviolence radio. Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence.
Challenging radio. Silence.
Nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Greetings, everyone. I'm here to challenge some silence with nonviolence in the news. And I'd like to start by paying respects to a departed nonviolent hero, Liu Xiaobo, who kept vigil in Tiananmen Square as a young man back in 1989 to protect the mainly student protesters from oncoming soldiers. And he went on to promote a pro-democracy charter that got him an 11-year prison sentence. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize of 2010 while still in prison, and unfortunately he died last Thursday at the age of 61. This is personal for me because it was because of the Tiananmen Square tragedy in 1989 that I dedicated my life to spreading information and understanding about nonviolence. I did that because the tragedy was preventable, and I and some of my colleagues saw that, but we had no way to reach the students in time. And I had the pleasure a few years ago of explaining this to some Palestinian activists, and I was pleased and surprised when they said, "We feel your pain. We felt the same way about that tragedy." So to move on now, look at some resources. I'd like to start with three news sources that I've collected. The repertoire is really growing out there. There are lots of places where you can go to get alternative news and even some coverage about nonviolence. So there's no reason in the world why we have to be addicted to mainstream media anymore. One of the three I'd like to cite today is, here's the website, one word, theopportunityagenda.org, theopportunityagenda.org. It allows you to select topic and type of resource in a kind of grid. It offers a toolkit for journalists, which is a very important resource, and has a fair amount to say about our messaging. Their main focus is on racial issues, but I'm sure that you can find a great deal there, even if you have another topic in mind. And then an oldie but very goodie is WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, WINGS. And because it is a women's service, it does tend to focus more on peace and nonviolence, and they are now celebrating their 25th year. They have an extensive archive, which I have not had time to check for its nonviolent content, but it looks promising. Something that I cited briefly last year is the Peace Science Digest, which is a product of the War Prevention Initiative. It's both online and in print, and it has an excellent selection of articles. But what I really like is the format, because each article ends with two boxes or choices, contemporary relevance and talking points. So those are very good takeaways. And just now, in collaboration with Waging Nonviolence, Peace Science Digest has run an article by Molly Wallace of importance to all of us. It's called How Movements Can Succeed in the Face of Government Repression. This is basically a review of an article by Erica Chenoweth, whom we've mentioned many times. Her article, Erica's, is called Trends in Nonviolent Resistance and State Response. And that's published in a book called Global Responsibility to Protect. Now, this is responding to a problem, quite a big dilemma that has come up in recent years. And that is that as we learn more about nonviolence and its effectiveness, so do governments. And the fact is that the effectiveness of nonviolent movements has gone down slightly in recent years because of this cleverness. Now, particularly clever governments, so this is my own addition, particularly clever governments like that of the State of Israel, caught on to this a long time ago. And that's why our good friend Mubarak Awad, who was starting the Nonviolent Center in Ramallah, was deported, while Sheikh Yassin, who was carrying out suicide bombing and was a mastermind of that kind of violence, which they maintain that they deplore, he was not touched, even though they know where he was. The encouraging part of this is that they're recognizing the power of nonviolence. But the discouraging part is that they're catching on and becoming more clever opponents. So we have to become even more clever, which I don't think will be impossible. Now, to move on to some commentary, we've been talking about the July 7th decision at the United Nations. 122 nations signed on to it to begin the process towards a total ban of nuclear weapons. On September 20th, that treaty becomes available for other nations to sign. When 60 nations sign it, it becomes law. And for a point-for-point roadmap of the process and what it means, what this lies ahead, there's an article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists by Zia Mian, which I think was very thorough and very insightful. He says, the ban requires that states that sign up to make membership of the treaty part of their political engagement. They sign up to require that part of their political engagement with the nuclear weapon states is included. In other words, they have got to propagandize to carry forward the drive to get them on board. The language is, each state party shall encourage states not party to this treaty to ratify, accept, approve, or accede to the treaty. Now, here's an interesting point from the point of view of nonviolence theory. Meehan says, this will require new kinds of official and public engagement with weapon states and opens the door for new kinds of transnational citizen diplomacy. So it won't be easy to persuade nuclear weapons countries to join the treaty, but, quote, it will require that governments and citizens use new forms of international politics that the treaty empowers. So what we're seeing is something that we frequently see with the practice of nonviolence in any area, and that is that you have unintended positive consequences. Here you have whole new political formats arising from this treaty because it is basically a nonviolent maneuver. So just as in any act of violence, there are unintended negative consequences, otherwise known as blowback in CIA language, so in nonviolent action, there are unintended positive consequences. Even if you fail, you do better than violent uprisings when they, quote, succeed. And this, I sometimes think, may be the most important thing to tell people about nonviolence, because we are always so goal-oriented. Yeah, we tried it, but we failed, so we're going back to violence. Well, you cannot possibly have totally failed. To the degree that your nonviolence was accurate and powerful, it created good in the situation. And if you're clever enough to connect the dots, you'll see that good later on. So to repeat, Alice Slater, writing in The Nation, she is a very prolific commentator on these issues, especially nuclear disarmament. She wrote, yet the absence of the nuclear weapons states contributed to a more democratic process. So in other words, the states that usually are pretty heavy-handed and bully their way around, they sat this process out, and other nations were able to come together and operate more democratically the way they did in Paris. Now, again, from Waging Nonviolence, they point out that the mobilization for health care is a strong example of how to incorporate different stakeholders using a wide variety of tactics. They show the importance of finding common ground has emerged, and especially this appeals to me a whole lot, to develop a common vision for the future that can shift the anti-Trump resistance from simply opposing his agenda to proposing an alternative path going forward. And that article was another article I want to talk about. It just came out on Thursday, July 20th, by Robert Kohler, the Chicago-based journalist who seems to have something insightful, almost inspiring to say just about every week. This article is called Dead Civilians and the Language of War. He recurs to a topic that I studied when I was at the university some years ago. And he says, murder begins with language. The language of war is what keeps it alive, he says. This is, and here's how it does it. This is the language of strategy and domination. And I want to emphasize this part, words without grief, words without compassion. So speaking truth to power, which is the true work of the media, cannot be done as long as reporters are writing in that language of power. He calls it an alien tongue in which some human beings are expendable. And that should serve to remind us of a famous quote that was collected by Hannah Arendt in her highly controversial book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. The prosecutors asked Eichmann how he could carry out such horrendous acts, day after day, how they all could do that. And he said it was our language that enabled us to do it. And what he was primarily talking about are euphemisms, words that conceal from you the humanity of the other and the horror of what you have done to them by relegating them to statistics or other kinds of euphemistic approach. Now, you remember a famous quote that was attributed to Hitler, is also attributed to Stalin, was perfectly worthy of either of them. One death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. It also should remind us of a famous article that was written in 1987 by Carol Cohn, who's now teaching, that's C-O-H-N, now teaching at UMass Boston. The article was called Sex and Death in the Rational Language of Defense Intellectuals. It was published in a journal called Signs, and I think it was reprinted three or four times. It was one of the jumping off points for our research back in the 80s, which was funded by the MacArthur Foundation until it wasn't. And in that article, she points out that not only is the language of nuclear weaponry euphemistic and dehumanizing, transferring humanity to inanimate things, both the two atomic bombs that were dropped on August 6th and August 7th were nicknamed Fat Boy and Little Man or something like that. So they were made into living, cutesy little objects. Not only that, but there was a lot of unfortunate sexual arousal in that language, making it subconsciously very exciting for the mostly male, quote, defense intellectuals who were planning all of this. I thought at the time, and I still think today, that that was an extremely powerful mode of research because it would enable us to pull the cover off a kind of self-deception that was happening, but either because I was right or because, that is to say, either because people saw the danger of what the research we were doing or because they didn't understand it, the funding kind of dried up and hasn't gone any further. But I think the basic point is quite important. And this is also why Gandhi was so intensely dedicated to truth, truth in language, non-euphemistic but not cruel speech everywhere. So to move on to the news, we do sometimes have to share some bad news. And today is one of those days. In our last show, we were so happy and enthusiastic about what our congresswoman from Oakland did. She's the only person, the only congressperson in 1991 to vote against the appropriations that made possible the Iraq War and all of the other Mideast conflicts that every president has pursued since then. She had attached an amendment to a bill which was going to rescind that endowment. So that would no longer be possible for presidents, and this was anti-constitutional in my amateurish view, to wage war without without accountability and without asking Congress for permission. And the really inspiring thing about that committee was that both sides of the aisle unanimously voted for this amendment. So we were very happy about that. But the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, has just surreptitiously removed it from the bill. So Barbara Lee commented, Congress has been missing in action on matters of war and peace for nearly 16 years. And you can see the connection there with euphemistic language. If you don't really face up to what you're doing, you can drift off and not do anything about the most important subjects. And unfortunately, it really looks as if these decisions are in the hands of people who fear democracy and peace and would do anything to prevent it from going forward. That is what we are up against. And it does remind me of what Arun Gandhi was just sharing with us about the ineffectiveness of government. Now, we have not paid a lot of attention to violence against animals, but there are those. one of them, our heroine, Arundhati Roy, who has said that she believes that what, if anything, is going to bring this country down, that is the U.S., down, it will be what we have done and are doing to animals. There's a very interesting, rather Indian viewpoint. But it definitely is a front in the struggle to overcome the culture of violence that Arun Gandhi was just referring to. And so I'm happy to report that this is a win, not a lose, that on Friday, a federal judge struck down a law that was passed in Utah, which is colloquially called the Ag-Gag Law, and that had prohibited unauthorized filming of agricultural operations. In other words, prohibited activists from documenting the abuse of animals. And this judge, U.S. District Judge Robert Shelby, said, I believe quite correctly, that this is a violation of free speech rights. So the activists had sued, two activist groups had sued over this agriculture operation interference law that was approved in 2012 by the Utah legislature and is now out. A new poll conducted by the NRG research group shows that 4 out of 5 Americans want food companies to commit to greatly reducing the suffering of chickens in their supply chains, even if it results in higher prices. So over and over again, a simple majority of the American people wants stronger gun laws. We want abolition of the death penalty. We want to end cruelty to animals. And we're willing to take the risks and make the sacrifices to make that happen. So that's an interesting thought. Why isn't it happening and how can we make it happen? So to get back to the human world, uninteresting as we are by comparison, I'd like to talk about 4 organizations, like to highlight them, because there's so much going on now in the organizational world. One is DIEM, called DIEM 25. It stands for the Democracy in Europe Movement, mainly based, as you might expect, in Europe. It has been very active, especially in Hamburg during the protests against the G20. And they are well aware that protests and violent clashes with the police don't achieve anything in themselves. And they point to the same example that we always point to. That is, in 2003, the largest global anti-war protest known in history took place, something on the order of 10 or 12 million people in 600 cities were against the war, but they were dismissed out of hand by the then sitting president, who said, I don't have to pay attention to these people. They are a focus group. In meta language, we were acting as though we were in phase one of the conflict escalation curve, where you can still argue and discuss things with your opponent. And he was in stage two, where he's not listening to us anymore, and we had to move forward into satyagraha, or active resistance. Thank you. So what they promote, a Democracy in Europe Movement, is aiming at something called constructive disobedience. And we will be trying to follow them for you in the weeks to come. Another second organization, and again, this is a really successful one, is called Results. Results, a commentator in the New York Times said, by the way, this is mainstream media. Let's tip our hats to them. They sometimes do something of quite a bit of interest and use. They said that Results is one of America's best kept secrets. For decades, it's been transforming everyday Americans into skilled and powerful advocates. This is mainly civil operations to elect local representatives and get laws passed and so forth. But they have the result of Results volunteers has been billions of dollars in federal government funding channeled to meet the basic needs of poorest people in the United States and around the world. And remember, if you're old enough, you will remember what Cap Weinberger said during the Vietnam War, a billion here, a billion there, and soon you're talking about real money. So this was in a column in a section of the New York Times, which is called Constructive Journalism. And I draw your attention to that. That was back up in the resource section. So Constructive Program, which is what they're doing, of course, was the heart and soul of Gandhi's work and something that we emphasize very heavily at META because it is the missing wing of nonviolent action. The third organization I'd like to cite briefly for you is called Indivisible. If I'm not mistaken, it goes back to Occupy with some help from the Harvard Resistance School. And this is the group that has actually been learning from the Tea Party, which blocked President Obama, to turn that method against blocking the incumbent. They are mostly interested in healthcare and immigration, which is similar to the Democracy in Europe movement. And similarly, there's a new merger that looks very promising. This is a merger of 99 Rise, which was an effective organization, with Democracy Spring, which was, if anything, and is, if anything, an even more effective organization. 99 Rise was born in the spring of 2012 in the wake of the Occupy movement. It was born in a living room in Los Angeles with seven people. And they now have a grand strategy for civic action culminating in, quote, a nationwide 50-state nonviolent army. I couldn't help patting myself and Stephanie on the back over this one, because a few years ago we were in that living room with Kai and with Sarah Thompson, and we talked about roadmap and the need for a grand strategy, which is what exactly we were calling it. Anyway, whether we did it or not, it's a good thing. Just wanted to quickly mention that there was some research showing that states that enacted an open carry law, so you could pack guns like into bars and all kinds of intelligent things like that, there was research that showed that gun homicides had gone down in those states, which doesn't compute. And so sure enough, the NRA mantra that the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun has been now disproven with better research. And our mantra is the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a person who doesn't divide the world into good guys and bad guys. So just to close now with a few events, and there's going to be on August 9th a March for Nuclear Disarmament sponsored by the Weapon States Nuclear Foundation. We have exactly the same attitude of the Democracy in Europe movement that marches and protests cannot be eschewed at this point in time. We need them, but they're mainly symbolic and an opportunity to network and not terribly effective in themselves. I'm happy to say Chi activism lives. Do you remember Chi activism that stopped ExxonMobil in Seattle? Well, 1 week before, this is going to take place in September 22nd to 24th at American University. World Beyond War will work with Backbone Campaign and others to organize a flotilla for the environment and peace, bringing Chi activism to Washington, D.C., on September 16th. One last event, and I'm skipping several that will appear on our website. August 6th, of course, that is Hiroshima Day. If you folks from West Marin would mind coming out east a little bit, in Walnut Park in Petaluma, we're going to have our annual Petaluma Progressives Fair. This year, there will be a Bharata Natyam concert, if that's your cup of tea. It's our cup of chai, for sure. And so come visit our table, the META Center, on August 6th. Stephanie.
We want to thank you so much, Michael Negler, for your segment, Nonviolence in the News. And we want to thank Arun Gandhi, our guest a grandson of Mahatma Gandhi for his discussion on the power of anger and nonviolence, for sure. And until the next time, everybody, take care of one another.